This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions.
So this is a question about my political philosophy, and it says, nobody asks this of the actual candidates because I think none would be able to answer it truthfully. Please give your answer to what is your philosophy of governance? Yeah, of course nobody asks that of political candidates because they don't have one. They don't have a philosophy. And if they try to articulate one, it would scare the bejesus out of us. My philosophy of governance, I take here governance as it applies to government, as it applies to the state, governing the state. And my philosophy is governance is very simple. The role of government is one, and that is to protect the individual rights of its citizens. Its only responsibility is to do that. Everything the government does needs to be measured by that criteria. Does this protect the individual rights of its citizens, or doesn't it? Does it violate rights, or doesn't it? And based on that, I would venture to say that 80 to 90% of everything government does today violates rights and therefore should be eliminated as quickly as practically feasible. And I realize that some of these things might take a generation or two to phase out. When it comes to policing, when it comes to property rights, when it comes to defense, all proper definition of property rights, all proper functions of government, the question needs to be asked. Again, does this protect individual rights? This is true of foreign policy. Are Americans' individual rights at stake in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine? In my view, no. So no action is necessary by the government when it comes to the Russian-Ukrainian. Now, is the fact that Russia is presided over by a thug relevant to the individual rights of Americans? Yes. As a government, I would say then I have to watch over him, make sure that he doesn't do anything. You know, if I'm going to spy on anybody, Putin's a good guy to spy on. Is spying on Angela Merkel, an ally, necessary for the protection of individual rights of Americans? No. Is spying on the Brazilian oil company necessary for the protection of individual rights of Americans? No. Is spying on individual Americans necessary for the protection of individual rights of Americans? No. Is spying on people who might be affiliated with ISIS and you have reason to believe might have some relationship? Yes. That's how the NSA should function. It can't collect data on all of us. It should collect data on those who are suspicious by some criteria, which has to be defined clearly based on whether it is protecting individual rights or violating individual rights. So in every aspect of what government does, the only question to ask, and it's not a simple question, there are tricky situations, but the question to ask is, does this violate or does this protect individual rights? And if it violates, you don't do it. And if it protects, you do it. And, these questions are not easy necessarily to ask and to answer, but it is what government is for. It is the government's only function. And therefore, if I were elected president, there would be a lot of unemployed government employees. That would be cool if one of the presidential candidates actually said that. There would be a lot of unemployed government employees, a lot of them, because I would slash, I would cut, I would disseminate, or disintegrate so many of the functions that the government does today because they're anti-individual rights and they are unconstitutional and they should be abolished.
Okay, so suppose I see somebody saying, for instance, that communism is the best economic system. If I try to reason with this person, he will just get angry and not listen at all. If I don't, he will endorse evil politicians. What should I do if anything.
You cannot ignore that. You cannot ignore it. Evil wins when the good is silent. So you have to say something. Does that mean you have to reason with them? No. You're not committed to engaging in argument with everybody you meet. You could say, that's ridiculous. History suggests the exact opposite, and indeed not just history. But communism is anti-life, and it's killed tens of millions of people, and it's evil, and walk away. You don't have to engage in conversation. All you have to do is plant the seed in that person's mind that he might be wrong. If he's honest, he'll investigate. If he's dishonest, you've at least expressed your opinion and maybe somebody heard you. At least he knows that he doesn't have your sanction. At least he knows that in this he's alone, or at least he doesn't have as many people supporting him as otherwise. Speaking up makes all the difference, and I think it is necessary for your own sanity. I can't walk by somebody spouting evil without commenting. I think it's the only way to change the world ultimately is to challenge bad ideas wherever one sees them, not as a duty, but just as a responsibility to oneself. And again, sometimes you want to engage with somebody in a whole debate. Sometimes one sentence is plenty. Sometimes just a horrified look on your face is good enough. So this is a question about the evaluation of business leaders, I guess. And it says, it seems to me that objectivism has relaxed a lot of its interpretation of moral character when it refers to people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs in its lectures and presentations. Is there concern about using these concrete examples because negative stuff comes out later, for example, about Steve Jobs? No, I don't think there's a concern. Ayn Rand did this when she talked about the robber barons. She used them as examples of her heroic individuals within the realm of business. She didn't make statement about their moral character beyond their heroism in the context of business and beyond their moral character when it came to their productiveness and their use of their reason in their mind when it came to business. And I think that's absolutely applicable to Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. Does that mean that when they go home, they don't do things that I would consider immoral? I certainly think Steve Jobs did with regard to not getting an operation that could have saved his life and going on a juice diet. That was irrational and therefore immoral. But I'm not saying that Steve Jobs in any of our presentations, that Steve Jobs is morally perfect. But he's morally good, certainly when it comes to his productive side of his life. Did he yell at his employees? Sure. But does that make somebody immoral? Yelling in a context of intense pressure and creation? I wouldn't have stayed married if it was immoral to yell at another human being. I don't know what you mean by stuff coming out about Steve Jobs. Certainly in his personal life, there's certain things. But also, be careful. You don't have the context. You're seeing what some biographer wrote about Steve Jobs. What I see is an iPhone. What I see is a company that went from the verge of bankruptcy to the biggest company in the world. So I see objective facts, and based on the objective facts that I have, Steve Jobs is a hero. Now, politically, he was wrong. Philosophically, he might have been wrong. That does not change the fact that he is somebody who applied his mind to shaping the world and the reality in which he lived. From everything we can tell, lived a life of ambition, of success. You know, to me, if Steve Jobs is not a hero, who's going to be a hero? Now, again, I'm not saying in every aspect of a life, unconditionally. But your moral evaluation is not just about how, you know, it's about what kind of life somebody's lived. This is not Christian morality, where you look at the Ten Commandments and you put check marks around which commandment did he fulfill. This is about, did he live life? Did he live life to the fullest? Did he make the most of his life? And with regard to Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, for the most part, the answer is they did. Doesn't make them perfect. Doesn't mean in every aspect. But it does mean that they can be used as examples, particularly when talking about productivity. The virtue of productiveness, they are brilliant examples of productiveness. Just like Ayn Rand did not try to say that the robber barons were perfect in every respect, but she had huge admiration towards them. So in light of the rise of the Islamic State and its occupation of the territories in Iraq and Syria, do you still hold up the idea
that the resolution of the Islamic threat would require seeing Iran as our main military target. I mean, isn't ISIS now as influential as the former in the jihadist movement that a new strategy may be required?
Now, yes and no. The only reason ISIS is influential, the only reason ISIS exists, is because we, the United States, was too weak after 9/11 to take care of the real problem. And at the time, we articulated that the real problem was not just Iran, it certainly was Iran, still is Iran, but also Saudi Arabia. Now, let's take Iran for a minute. There would be no ISIS if not for Iran. Iran still, to this day, represents the only successful application of Sharia law consistently throughout the rule of government. The government, they apply Sharia law. Now, it applies it selectively because it doesn't want to upset its people too much because they're afraid of revolution. But it is a regime dedicated to Sharia law and that is winning. It even won concessions from the United States. Nobody challenges them. They are beacon. They are the city. They are the shining city on a hill for Islamists. Sunni or Shia, it doesn't matter. It worked in Iran. It can work anywhere else. So that's Iran. Now, on top of that, Iran actually has an army. Iran has missiles. It possibly has ballistic missiles. It will have a nuclear weapon. And it has vast more resources. It's bigger. It's more influential. They're militarily more powerful than ISIS is. In that sense, Iran is still the number one military threat. It's still a trivial threat to the United States because if we used our military, it would be nothing. But it's still the most powerful military in that part of the world right now. Now let's take Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is very weak militarily. That's why it considers itself an ally of the United States. And yet Saudi Arabia has funded all the groups that have led to the creation of ISIS. They funded Al-Qaeda. They funded the madrasas to this day where all the radicalization happens. They fund, in the United States, mosques where all of these guys, these so-called homegrown terrorists in Europe and in the United States, all trained in mosques funded by the Saudis. The Saudis are the money behind the Sunni radicalization. In other words, they are the money behind ISIS. So without Saudi Arabia, I don't believe ISIS would exist. And without Saudi Arabia today, ISIS wouldn't exist for very long. It's still true that in my view, the primary military targets should be Iran and Saudi Arabia. Dealing with ISIS after that would be easy. It would be, you know, a few days you could wipe them out. So this is not hard. It's just a matter of identifying. You see, the problem is nobody will identify, or very few people will identify, the source of the problem as being ideological. The source of the problem is radical Islam or Islamism or jihadism. Then the question is, what are the roots of jihadism? Where is it preached? Where is it taught? Where is it funded? Saudi Arabia and Iran. If you take out those two elements, everything else, you might still have to deal with a cleanup, but the cleanup will be trivial as compared to dealing with those two. And there are plenty of podcasts. You can, if you click on foreign policy and the podcasting, there are plenty of podcasts where I cover what I think should be done with Iran and Saudi Arabia, so I'm not going to repeat myself here.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.